right, so last week we looked more closely at the writer's description that Jesus in his being is described as having the exact imprint of his nature. Now, the Greek word rendered here is as imprint is the word charakter, which is the English word in which we derive character. Now, this word isn't described using described as someone merely acting like someone else, but rather it's more akin to a print character. Now, as we discussed as well, the writer could have used the typical word that describes a depiction of something, and that word is icon, where we derive our word icon from, and is rendered here as image. However, the writer is not trying to convey that Jesus looks like God, but rather that he is God. But in contrast, the concept of mankind being in the image of God would more reflect the use of the word icon, because we image or reflect the character of God in some ways, in some respect, the rest of the creation does not. But at the same time, we do not bear, as images of God, the exact image of God, right? There are things about us that are not like God and vice versa. Now, whenever the word character is used, it's typically referred to as used in the context of a stamp that bears the exact image of a particular thing. For example, the word was often used of the stamp that would imprint the image of the Roman emperor on a coin. Now, this image was considered to be an exact likeness of the emperor, not some loose depiction of him. And really, this is why the coin had value, because it had the full weight of the emperor's power behind it. But then we looked at the writer's declaration that the reason that Jesus bears the exact image of God is because Christ bears the very nature of God. Or as the Greek says, hupostasis is in Greek. Now, the word here is where we derive the term hypostatic union, which means that the Son in his being was one in person, but at the same time possessed both a divine nature and a human nature. Now, this certainly is a mystery, but as we discovered a few weeks ago, the early church painstakingly pored over the scriptures and concluded that there was no other possibility other than the fact that the Son was both divine and human. And if you recall, in the Council of Nicaea, they came up with the term, or they actually decided on the term, homoousia, means of the same substance, right? That Jesus was the same substance with the Father. Yet the importance of this declaration isn't just that Jesus is God and therefore is one with the Father, but it also harkens back to the statement made by the author of Hebrews back in verse 2, where he said, "In these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son." Now, as we discussed, the role of prophet was one of the mouthpiece of God. As we know, these prophets were imperfect and sinful because they could not bring the fullness of revelation of God to mankind. Now, in the history of Israel, Moses was the standard bearer of true prophecy, as he had a unique relationship with God. Again, his relationship is he was one who spoke with God face to face, right, as with a friend. But despite this relationship, Moses wasn't allowed to see the promised land because, as we know, in the story of the waters of Meribah, he struck the rock when he was told to merely speak to it. Now, Moses, knowing his failings, knew that he was not going to be the one who would bring the fullness of God's revelation to the people. And that's why Moses told Israel, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen." But then we fast-forwarded last time in time and looked again at the account where Jesus' glory was revealed on the Mount of Transfiguration. Now it's telling who appeared with Jesus there on the Mount. It was Moses and it was Elijah. Now, I don't think it was accidental that Moses was a part of that group, for Moses' presence was now going to visually bear witness of his prophecy that he declared some 1,500 years earlier of the great prophet to come. He's saying that he is here. But more so than Moses' presence was God's voice, the Father's thunderous voice from heaven, which declared, "This is my beloved, my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Again, the same words that Moses would say 1,500 years earlier. The Father is affirming, this is that great prophet. He is the ultimate prophet. So this means that Jesus is the ultimate prophet, and he's not so just because he's perfect, although he is, and not just because he completely fulfilled all prophecy, although he did. No, Jesus is the ultimate prophet because he is God. And we think, if you think about it, who better to declare the will of God than God himself, right? But as we also discussed, the glorious aspect of this is that while God in his divinity was not approachable because of his radioactive glory, God took the form of human flesh in order to demonstrate the fullest revelation of himself. And then we looked at John 14, where Jesus declared to the disciples that he would have to go away in order to prepare a place for them, in order that they may dwell in the Father's house. But all this talk of the Father was very perplexing to the disciples. After all, they heard him speak of the Father many times, but they doubted what he said. You recall what Philip asked. He said, "Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us." In essence, Philip was saying that he thought Jesus was insufficient in his prophetic revealing of the Father. It was still very mysterious to him. His vision was clouded. But what Philip couldn't understand is Jesus would not reveal the Father in the way that the Old Testament prophets did. For they were only able to speak for God in limited ways, ways that spoke in shadows, not in substance. Most of the time, we know, as we discussed before, the prophets spoke the verbatim words of God, being the mouthpieces of God. But then in rare occasions, God would reveal his power through them. And he would demonstrate that it was he that was indeed speaking through them, through his powerful acts. But Jesus didn't merely relay the words of God, nor was God using him as a vessel for his power. But as John says in chapter 1, he is the Word of God, and demonstrated his power as one who actually possesses that power. Unlike the prophets who were empowered by God, Jesus already had the power himself. And that is why Jesus replies back to Philip, "Have I been with you so long, and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me?" And what is Jesus saying here? He's saying that only he can reveal the Father. Why? Because as he says in the last statement, because he and the Father are one. To see Christ then was to see the Father. But also what Philip didn't understand is that it was not Jesus, it wasn't as if Jesus is the only way to see the Father because God just deliberately limited the ways he could be seen, but because the only possible way for the Father to be seen is through Jesus. Again, he said earlier in John chapter 14 that he is the way, the truth, and the life. So it's exclusive because there's no other way to see the Father. He's the only game in town. But the implication of this reality of the Son and the Father's unity is this. When we go to the place prepared for us that Jesus spoke of in John chapter 14, we will not see the Father directly, but we will see the Son in his glorified state. But what does Jesus mean, though, in his statement, "If you have seen me, you have seen the Father," mean for us? It means that when we get to heaven, we will see the Father through the eyes of the Son. When we behold him, we will behold the Father's glory because he is the exact imprint of the Father's nature. And then we close last time by looking at the Apostle Paul's description of the writer of Hebrews' declaration that Jesus is the exact imprint of the Father, that as Paul says, that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And so this statement declares why Jesus is the end of all prophecy. For finally, in the person of Jesus, can we now see what was impossible to see? The very goal of prophecy, the end of prophecy, the revelation of what seemingly could not be revealed, but God himself, right? Now, as we continue this week, we're going to move on to the writer's next phrase, as he says that Jesus is the one who upholds the universe by the word of his power. Now, already in verse 2, we discussed that Jesus is the agent through whom also he, that is God, created the world. That is, the Son was the member of the Godhead that brought about the existence of all things, and so proved by that right that Christ is appointed as the heir of all things. So because he created the world, in other words, it means that he, by right, is the king of the world. But the kingship of Christ is not merely proven by the fact that Christ made the world, but also because he continues to sustain it. This means that God is not inactive and lets things go in the universe, right? No, instead, Christ is continually and actively involved with every aspect of the inner workings of the cosmos. Again, as R.C. Sproul says, his famous saying, there's no maverick molecule in the universe. Everything is being held together by him, is working together because of him and his power. So he's actively engaged. Now, in our study last year in Progressive Christianity, we briefly looked at the Age of Enlightenment. This period that spanned the 17th and 18th centuries A.D. was an era characterized by a paradigm shift that no longer just assumed that God was the standard of truth, but instead that man was the measure of all things. But this shift to complete human autonomy did not happen overnight, did it? But it began by weakening God's role in the world. This began with a new conception of God called deism. Deism basically, if you were with us and we looked at this for a couple of weeks, deism is the belief that God is like a curious collector. Oh, that kind of died there for a second. Must have hit it. So deism is basically a belief that God is like a curious clockmaker. That is, he created the world, he wound it up, and established the laws of nature to run things. So therefore, deism would reject the notion that God is involved in the world in any way, but instead insists that he's just observing mankind, seeing what we will do. So the idea that God actively participates and sustains the universe also must be rejected. The idea that the universe is a clock means that the universe does not rely on any external source for it to function. So, God made the world so well, they say, that the world can function on its own without inside intervention. But the problem with this worldview is twofold. First, we know that the universe, while it's amazing in its complexity, is breaking down and is filled with things that indicate imperfection. Of course, we know that God created the world as perfect and good in the beginning. But what happened? The fall happened, didn't it? And it introduced sin, and sin introduced decay and death. As Paul tells the Roman church, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know the whole creation has now been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. So what Paul is saying here is that because of mankind's fall, the rest of the universe was subjected to death and decay, or as he describes here, futility. So the good earth that God created is compromised and corrupted until the time when Christ will return and make all things new. the time, as he declares, when the sons of God will be fully revealed in their glorified state. David.
Climate change can't be changed.
No. No, it's climate change, as we know it, is as a result of the fall. The fact that it gets overly hot and cold and things like that is a result of the fall. There's nothing man can do about it. We are powerless to control the seasons. There's only one, and Job says, who controls the thunder, right? Who controls the lightning? Who controls the clouds? It's God himself. And we have to trust, again, that's right, a state of entropy anyway. Until that time, right? Until that time. I can't imagine what the weather is going to be like in the new heavens, new earth. I hope it's 70 degrees. I mean, that's my wishes anyway. As I've told you before, some people are, you know, they like really hot weather or really cold weather. I don't like either. So I'm pretty good with 70 degrees. So, you know, if there's any requests in the new heavens, new earth, I would request to be 70 degrees all the time. Regardless, back to our conversation. But the second problem with deism is that it paints a God who's just a passive observer. And frankly, if he's a passive observer, that means he's not frankly invested in his creation, is he? But the writer of Hebrews, along with the rest of Scripture, paints a different picture, doesn't it? The writer describes a creator who upholds the universe by the word of his power. Now, the Apostle Paul in Colossians chapter 1, a passage that we have quoted quite extensively so far, it seems to be a parallel passage to the first part of Hebrews here, conveys a similar thought. As Paul says, that Christ is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So here Paul conveys the idea that we have said before, that God in the person of Jesus Christ is the very definition of what's referred to as a necessary being, right? Now, according to the biblical definition of ontology, or the nature of being, there are only two possible types of beings. There is the necessary being, and is referred to as the contingent being. Now, by definition, a necessary being simply means that it is necessary that the being exists for other things to exist. This being is therefore the source of all being. Therefore, everything else by definition is what? Contingent, right? It's contingent. That is, they rely on the existence of the necessary being for their own existence. Now, by definition, there is only one being that meets that criterion of a necessary being, right? And as Paul states in Colossians, God is the only necessary being, and in the person of Christ is the one who ensures the existence of everything else is maintained. So although this is a logical impossibility, if it were hypothetically possible for God to exist, everything else would cease to exist, right? Because everything hinges or is contingent upon him, right? Everything flows from him. And as Paul says, all in him all things hold together. The whole universe would fall apart if God were to cease to exist. But in light of this truth, the true mystery of the incarnation is not just the fact that the Son took on the form of human flesh, but while taking on human flesh, he continued his duty of deity, ensuring the universe continued to hold together. And really, this is something we don't really think about a lot, but it's a mind-blowing fact that Jesus, while he was walking on the earth in his humanity, in his deity, he continued to hold the universe together. I can't imagine how that's even possible, but that's what Scripture says. He didn't give up that duty. He didn't give up that responsibility. He continued. Again, that is the nature and the mystery of the hypostatic union. Again, in the one person of the Son, he was fully human and was fulfilling everything on our behalf, living on our behalf, and then dying on our behalf. At the same time, he was upholding the universe by the word of his power. It's an amazing mystery, and really should cause us to fall into a state of doxology, right? That God would would empty himself, right? As we, Pastor Stan has looked at, when we look through Philippians, he emptied himself. He gave up the glories of heaven and took on sinful flesh in order that we might be redeemed. But what further compounds the awesome wonder of this mystery is that the writer of Hebrews says that he upholds the universe by the word of his power. Now, this harkens back to the creation account in Genesis. If you look at some of the ancient myths regarding the way the deities created the world, they're described as creating the world many times by sexual means. In Greek mythology, for example, in the beginning, there was only chaos and darkness. But then the divine being, Something must be wrong with the mic. Sorry. There it goes. Gaia, which is representative of the earth, emerged from that void of nothingness.
So we got something out of nothing.
Yes. And what's funny is a lot of these myths, there is this imagery of this void of chaos. In fact, that's the way that the Greek mythology is described, is this god of chaos, this nothingness, in which all of a sudden, out of nothing, comes these other deities. And so you can see that they know this really has to be the way that it came. There had to be some kind of first being. And it's a logical necessity to have any kind of functional worldview, right? And so they recognize that. David? Right. That's right. And the you know, what's inconsistent with the ancient religions is the fact that many times their gods did have a beginning. Now, they're kind of nebulous in the way it's not really well explained, for example, in Greek mythology, how Gaia, for example, came to come from nothing. But that she did. and so a lot of these deities they're representative of elements of the universe. You'll see that. That's what makes actually Judaism quite distinct, is that the God Yahweh is not attached to the sun or the river, or in the case like the Egyptians, the frogs or any type of other gods. He is completely other than. He's not like any other deities there. It's because, as we are told before, what was Moses' big argument in retelling the creation account? Who was he talking to? He was talking to the Israelites who were under bondage of Egypt. And who were the Egyptians serving? They were serving the sun god. They were serving the frog god. They were serving the water gods. And he's saying, guess what? Yahweh created them all. And so he is far superior to any of these other deities. And so really, that kind of is, in a way, a proof that the God of the Bible is the actual God, is that it's not derived from anything in our imagination, but he really is other than, right? He really is other than. But Gaia, having emerged from the void of nothingness, then, as the myth goes, miraculously gives birth to Uranus. Yes, let's hold off on the jokes here, okay? Let's hold off on the jokes. But Uranus is represented the sky. So Gaia gives birth to the sky. But then, of course, as in many Greek myths, he impregnates his own mother to produce the Titans, which then, through more sexual acts, produce the rest of the elements of the universe. So you can see it's a very carnal, very earthy kind of religion, kind of worldview. This is not a God that's other than, right? These are gods that are very much like you and me, right? It just appears out of nothing, right? It's very, very confusing. Now, likewise, in Babylonian mythology, in the beginning, there was only the sea, and she was personified by the water goddess Tiamat, and the underground waters personified by the male god Apsu. Now, as the account goes, these two deities mingled their waters together, and soon they produced children who became the gods of the other elements of creation. Again, very similar type of thing, very carnal way of... But you see, this also shows is that without revelation, you're going to rely and base your beliefs on things that you know, things that are very familiar with your everyday life, rather than a God who is other than, who is not like you in any way, in most ways, especially in regards to the way he conducts himself, right? And so you can see a very marked difference between the ancient views of creation and then, as we will now discuss, in Genesis. Because in Genesis, it doesn't describe God as creating the world by carnal and earthly means, does it? But it simply says that God spoke, and then there it was. How many times did it say that in Genesis chapter 1? It says, and God said, let there be light, and what? Guess what? And there was light, right? He didn't have to exercise in carnal or earthly means. It was just by the word of his power, markedly different than the other ancient religions. And only by the word of his power did all things come into being. But the part that the writer of Hebrews doesn't want you to miss is that not only did God bring all into existence by a mere word, but he continually sustains it by his word too. So he brought all of creation into existence by his word, and guess what? We're here continually because of his word. He spoke it, and we came to be, and we continue to be, right? He is the same yesterday, today, and forever, right? And again, his word is eternal, right? Sire?
I just have a question. I might just be way off base, but in comparison with those others that they have the male and the female, is that why Usans created Mother Nature? Because we had to have...
Yeah, Mother Nature is derived from the Greek myth of Gaia. Yeah, she is Mother Earth because everything comes from her. Again, like I mentioned in the beginning, she almost had like a virgin birth, right? She had like a virgin birth, and as she produced Uranus, and then he helped her along, and then they had other children, which produced the rest of the elements of creation, right? David?
The Greek mythology, as well as the Roman mythology, come from the same Proto-Indo-Europeans, and they called the sky father Jupiter, and that was like sky father.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you get Zeus from the Deus, and then Dio, and then also Jupiter came down to Jupiter. So you get Dio, Jupiter, and Zeus all from that, way pre-ancient European,
right?
Steppe nomads.
Right, right. But what's interesting about those gods is they didn't really have a part in the general creation account. It's these almost like pre-gods, the ancient gods, the ones that really predate everything. And then later on, you get the Parthenon and the Zeus and all the other gods that you know in the stories. And what are they really? They're just basically glorified humans, right? Powerful humans, superhumans. They're not much different than you and me. In fact,
they're silly too. They'll explain like a mountain, like a god stubbed his toe, and like the carpet crumpling.
Right. That's exactly right. They're trying to base things that they don't know and try to explain them away in more humanly or earthly terms. And there is, in fact, a mystery in the way that God created the world. I mean, how the Grand Canyon came to be. We don't know exactly how the Grand Canyon came to be. Some speculate it was a flood. Perhaps God, it's very possible God could have already had it shaped at the beginning. It is a beautiful marvel, isn't it? And ultimately, it's not for us, is it? It's for him. It's for his glory. And so we, as we marvel about these things, we realize that ultimately what he has done by his glory, and done for his glory, and he's done by the word of his power. And it's no effort for him. It's no effort. So, and you can see, like in these ancient myths, there's all this turmoil and all of this chaos and things going on in order to make the universe. And God is just as orderly as can be, right? He shapes everything the first 3 days, and he fills it the next 3 days. There's no effort for God here. He's perfectly in balance. He knows exactly what he's doing. As none of this happens by accident. It doesn't happen like you'd mentioned him, God stubbing his toe, making a mountain. No, God is shaping it like a master craftsman, like an artist. Right? That's how our God is different from the other gods, is that he is deliberate in everything that he does. He's perfect in everything that he does. And therefore, when he speaks the word, it is done and it is perfect. And of course, as he declared at the end, it is good, right?
Reliable.
Yes, absolutely. Reliable, that's exactly right. So Jesus is not only the one who made us, not only the one who saves us, but is also the one who holds you continually together. And that's why it's absolutely mind-blowing how men can continue in an attitude of ingratitude towards God, right? The fact that he lives his breath every day in ingratitude. He doesn't even think about God. He goes about his daily ways, just doing things his own way. In fact, in many times, he may even curse God if he doesn't like the outcome of his life, right? Rather than the God who's continually sustaining him at that very moment, right? But lastly, as we get ready to close, there's also something else the writer in Hebrews, in that phrase, I don't want you to miss. Now, the word translated as upholds here doesn't quite give us the full picture of what the writer is trying to say. Now, the Greek word translated as uphold is pheron. Now, the word, while it can certainly mean to uphold or undergird, it can mean more than that. In fact, the writer of Hebrews does mean it more than that, because it can also mean carrying or bearing. In fact, this is the same word that Jesus used in John chapter 15 when he tells that describes as the good branches as bearing good fruit, right? So what is that telling you? It's telling you there is a purpose. There is an intent behind it, right? So while the subtle change, the idea of caring is not that just Christ maintains the universe then, but instead he moves the universe towards an intended purpose and end, right? So again, it's not like deism that we discussed of a God who made the universe and let it be governed blindly and aimlessly by the laws of nature. No, he's just not pumping energy into the universe. That's not what Christ is doing. The writer of Hebrews is saying, no, the Son is maintaining the universe for an ultimate end. But what's that end? Well, we're going to have to wait till next week. I got you on a cliffhanger here, because the next phrase will define for us what that end is. Again, everything that God does is, going back to our point a moment ago, everything is deliberate. Again, this was a plan before the foundation of the world, in which the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit counseled together in the Godhead and determined that this end would be brought about, right? It would be very defined roles for each. The Father would send the Son would come and live and die on our behalf and accomplish salvation, would bring us justification, and then finally that the Holy Spirit would seal us through sanctification.